Jackson, W266, DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Liberty Mutual Insurance.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. The farm worker accused of killing seven people in Half Moon Bay, California, makes his first court appearance. CBS's Danya Backus.
66-year-old Half Moon Bay shooting suspect Chun Li Zhao did not speak and tried to hide his face during his arraignment Wednesday afternoon. He's charged with seven counts of murder and one count of attempted murder, along with weapons violations.
The penalty if convicted of all the charges would be life without parole or death.
Zhao did not enter a plea and is being held without bail. Two attorneys were appointed to represent him.
Vice President Kamala Harris has visited Monterey Park, California, to meet with survivors and first responders of last Saturday night's mass shooting at a dance hall where 11 were killed. The Newport News, Virginia School Board votes to oust Superintendent George Parker III. It comes after the January 6th shooting of teacher Abby Zwirner, allegedly by a six-year-old student. Zwirner's lawyer, Diane Toscano.
School administration was warned by concerned teachers and employees that the boy had a gun on him at the school.
Toscano says Zwirner plans to sue the school district. In Texas, Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo has checked out the damage from yesterday's tornado in the Houston metro area.
We are working to request aid from the federal government at minimum in terms of low-interest loans, SBA loans, which are for small businesses and for residents.
President Biden says the U.S. is sending 31 M1 Abrams battle tanks, among other military aid, to Ukraine. Mr. Biden says it's part of the worldwide commitment to help Ukraine defend itself.
The Abrams tanks are the most capable tanks in the world. They're also extremely complex to operate and maintain. So we're also giving Ukraine the parts and equipment necessary to effectively sustain these tanks on the battlefield.
Meta says it's lifted its ban of former President Trump. CBS's Matt Piper.
Former President Trump's two-year suspension from Meta's Facebook and Instagram accounts will be lifted in the coming weeks, says the company.
It's a move they had to make.
Alan Adamson is with brand consultant firm Metaforce.
Their big competitor, Twitter, has done it. Business is tough. If he behaves, he deserves, if we believe in free speech, to be back on Facebook and Instagram.
While Trump was reinstated on Twitter in November, he has yet to send a new tweet. Matt Piper, CBS News.
GOP House Speaker Kevin McCarthy blocks Democrats from the House Intelligence Committee. Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff.
This decision by Kevin McCarthy to bow to the demands of the most extreme elements of his conference and use the Intelligence Committee as this kind of political plaything doesn't show the strength of his speakership. Indeed, it shows the weakness of his speakership.
Speaker McCarthy says years of service cannot be the sole criteria for membership on an essential committee. This is CBS News.
Nobody should have to pay for one-size-fits-all insurance coverage. Liberty Mutual customizes your car and home insurance so you only pay for what you need. Liberty Mutual Insurance.
A progressive voice for rural Wisconsin. WAUK 540 AM. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matner with your headlines. The question of what constitutes as a missing address on an absentee ballot might soon have an answer. State law doesn't define what a complete address is. The Wisconsin Elections Commission hasn't said what an incomplete address is, but has issued guidance saying that an address must have three things: a street number, street name, and municipality. A League of Women Voters asking a judge to clarify what a missing address is to clear up confusion for local election clerks. Republicans want the case thrown out on a technicality. A Dane County Circuit judge expected to issue a written ruling within a month. Calls to Wisconsin's suicide and crisis lifeline skyrocketing since the hotline switched to a simpler 988 number. WPR reporting between August and December of last year, the crisis lifeline got nearly 30,000 calls, a 66% jump in volume compared to the same time period in 2021. You're listening to The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM.
It's a new year, and because we're excited about our new and still growing Civic Media network of radio stations, it's time to do something really big. How does a $1 million advertising giveaway sound to you? Our celebration is your chance to work with Civic Media's amazing sales team, creating a radio advertising campaign promoting your business for free. Save the date. The $1 million advertising giveaway is only happening on Thursday, January 26th. Full details on our website, civicmedia.us/million.
Catch Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow at its brand new time, 6 to 8 a.m. weekdays. the city of Shanghai started administering an inhalable COVID-19 vaccine. I hear a lot of you saying the same thing I had in my head. I don't know about that.
As long as they're not just crop dusting everyone.
Crop dusting, that's exactly what I think people would be fearful of. I would not trust the Chinese government. I would trust people who really know about inhaling something and the good that it does you. Of course, I'm talking about Dom and Crute.
Thursdays at 11:30, we are joined by Dr. Michael McCutcheon, who is a psychologist, a lecturer, and additionally, he's won 10,000 fantasy football leagues and loves to help people make easy, free money. Dr. Mike fixes your life and your lineup.
Listen Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
The Shaw 101 FM, Franklin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com. Bringing some sanity to the airwaves. The Shaw 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM.
And we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you may remember last week we were talking about this House File 3 out in Iowa. The good Republicans out there, you know, the pro-life people, the good God-feared Christian folk, they're rewriting their SNAP rules. And who can get food and, well, who can't? Putting some pretty draconian means testing in place. Some of the definitions of what you can get. No white bread. Only whole wheat. And look, you know, there's part of me goes, okay, Iowa, the wheat producer, right? Maybe that's good for the state. Seems really draconian. Seems really kind of punitive. Especially at a time where we should be helping people. But here to share some thoughts on House File 3 and what's going on in the Iowa House of Representatives, I've asked our good friend J.D. Scholten to come. He's an Iowa State Representative. We need more people like this in houses across the country. J.D., thanks for taking time for us.
Always a pleasure to be on here. Thanks for having me.
Or should I say, Mr. Representative, thank you for coming and joining us. you're now somebody. You're a state rep. Good for you, man. Congrats.
Thank you. It's been interesting. This is week three, and I'm at the Iowa Capitol right now.
So let's talk about this House File 3, because I went into it and beat it up pretty badly. Going into some of the, you can only get certain kind of baby food, no fruit in the baby food.
Right.
I mean, it's the kind of cruelty that I saw in this, and I know a lot of their policies, the cruelty is the point, but we're talking about feeding people, JD. It shouldn't be this difficult.
Right. It's absolutely absurd. And here's the more absurdity part of it. You think of Iowa, you think of agriculture. And this is pushing people to eat canned food from that's not from Iowa. And I mean, specifically, you think of like Iowa's number one pork producer in the nation. And yet, like, people on SNAP can't have pork. It is so absurd. And the reality is I started talking to people across Iowa on this, and I was like, what's with this bill? And they're like, oh, you know, what it boils down to, they didn't read it. And they're like, oh, we're going to change it, blah, blah, blah. Well, you haven't changed it yet. It's been out for several weeks now, or at least a week and a half. And it's such crap. It's so frustrating because at the end of the day, you know what? When it comes to a tax break for a corporation for super wealthy people, they're on it like this. But when it comes to helping out just folks, regular folks who are working hard, it's hard to come by. And the reality, 300,000 Iowans are food insecurity right now, and a third of that are children. And for them to have these, like you mentioned, draconian measures, it's just absolutely awful.
No, I come back to it. The cruelty seems to be the point. I can come up with no other justification, because you pointed out something, and I talked about this last week, that is really important. You guys are an agricultural state. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, okay, if the legislation said it has to be Iowa produced, you know, we got to get, right, you know, bacon for breakfast every day. You know, I could get behind that, because there's some rationale. Okay, right. It's going to create jobs. It's going to help. It's going to help, you know, our economy. It's going to move that forward. It's not that though. It's no right. fresh meat. That's the other part. No canned tuna and spam. That's all you get.
It's. I mean, it doesn't make sense. So the reality of this bill is what I was told was the last session there was several bills that they tried to combine together, and so this is one of the worst parts of the bill. The second worst part of this bill is a different section that is on assets, and it gets a little
the means testing.
Yeah, so if you have one car, you're exempt. If you have a second car, that's $7,000, anything above $7,000. So if you have a $7,000 car, you lose all your SNAP benefits. Think just how absurd that is. If you're two working family, or you have you and your partner, or you and your spouse, whatever, are working, and one of you have a car, a car valued over $7,000, and with used car sales jacking up prices, like, it's very easy to do. It's so absurd. Just help people. It's not hard.
No, all these asset tests, JD, and you know this as well as anyone, are about putting roadblocks in front of people. And not about actually helping. Look, I'm of the mindset we should be helping people put food on the table. I'm almost to the point of going to, we need a universal basic income kind of scenario to help working families, because things have gotten so bad and things have gotten so radical. But, you know, these means tests, you know, look, I don't want someone who's living in a $1 million mansion, driving Mercedes and all of this, you know, abusing a system. But you know what? If they fall on hard luck, in the wealthiest country in the history of civilization, at its wealthiest moment, I think a meal is the least we can do to give people a helping hand.
Exactly. And one of the big things that I'm trying to push, and my goal here, and it's not going to get over one term or one year, whatever, is, you know, we're, as Iowans, we're missing out on millions and millions of dollars because our agriculture system is meant for this mass production of stuff, which is mostly corn and soybeans.
Right.
That ends up mostly feeding our animals, or some of the corn, 60% of the corn goes into ethanol. But we are missing out on more of a regional food system, and we don't feed ourselves. 90% of the food Iowans consume is imported, which is nuts. When you think about Iowa, you think about agriculture and growing all this stuff, but yet 90% of the food we consume is imported. And so what I want to do is create a regional food system and create that infrastructure of whether it's farm to school, farm to nursing home, farm to community college, like create that infrastructure. And the want is there, especially during the pandemic. We saw that people really want to know where their food's coming from.
Yeah.
And in Iowa, if we can create the infrastructure, I think it can really take off. And that's one of my many goals.
And it'd be a boom for the state, because the SNAP program is fully funded by the federal government. The only part that the state has to pick up is half of the administrative cost. So this is a lot of money coming into your state that could really grow jobs, could really grow opportunities. It seems like, again, very short-sighted cruelty and missing the long-term opportunities.
Absolutely. And that point right there is exactly right. This is not like we're allocating funds, state funds from this to that or anything like that, or we're saving money at the sale. We're not saving money at all. It's federally funded. And you're exactly right. It's cruel.
No, I mean, it's crazy stuff. But here's the thing, JD, and we talked about this when we were in Iowa. And look, Iowa is a beautiful state, flat state, all fields, all farm fields. It could be used for all the stuff that you want to do. And green. I mean, I never saw so many windmills that I saw in Iowa. I'm going, beautiful. But we talked about, you know, when we were there, you know, how your state had become a very radical state. What was once a solidly moderate Democratic state, good salt of the earth, hardworking people, has become a very radical state. And you said, you know, and I'm not going to put words in your mouth. You basically said it was talk radio that did this.
Well, it's a combination of talk radio and social media. I mean, the amount of mis and disinformation you see on especially Facebook to go along with talk radio. On election night in my hometown, the talk radio, which growing up, it was just, it just said the news. It wasn't really partisan. It just talked about what's going on in the nation, talked what's going on locally. That station now, it's pumping 10 hours of propaganda a day. They were talking about red wave all day, pushing their listeners to go out, vote red. And it's disheartening to see that at a level where like it, when I mention I'm a Democrat to folks, there's a disgust there where before, like growing up, it was just like, oh, that's fine. You're a Democrat. This person's Republican. We can talk together. We're all Iowans, whatever. But now it's so partisan, and they're just pushing that hatred. And then you start mentioning the policies of what's happening down here to folks, and they're bothered by it. Like, we just passed school vouchers here. And what's absolutely absurd. Okay. If you want to argue school vouchers and vouchers that in the state of Iowa, and if they have a role to play, that's one thing. But the bill that they passed here on Monday night is they gave an unlimited amount of money to a corporation that's going to oversee everything with no oversight and no public audit, no public record, no public report of anything. And that's just absolutely absurd. And our state quarter is foundation in education. Like, it's mind blowing. Yeah. Absolutely just mind blowing what's happening in the state.
No, and you know, they talk about they're indoctrinating the children while they're systematically defunding and destroying public education. So they can do what? They can indoctrinate the children. I mean, it's and the thing is if you can keep people, and I think you put this perfectly, if you can get people hating each other because they have the red hat or the blue hat, you can pass all of these cruel, draconian policies, and nobody's going to think twice because, hey, that my team, it must be okay because my team moved this forward, and it's right. Hurting the other team. This is not a good place.
Yeah, I mean, as far as I can tell, it's to own the libs. It's not to benefit Iowa. It's to own the libs. And it drives me absolutely insane because at the end of the day, so many of my neighbors, so many of the people in my community get left behind. And I mean, that's part of the reason, like, I did not want to run again after my congressional races, but it was about a year ago now that I found out the person who had the seat was not running for reelection. And I initially said, no, I'm done. I'm exhausted. But, then they started attacking school teachers. And like I said, our state's foundation, our state quarter and our motto, foundation in education. And that's what it's like, no, I've built so much of my voice. I'm not one to sit on the sidelines. And so here I'm literally at the state capitol tonight, trying to fight the good fight.
No, you're there, and it doesn't look like there's a lot of people around you. So you're out there putting in the late hours. And good. Look, this is what we need. We need people who are going to be champions. We need people who are going to go in there and fight for working families. Because sadly, I look at this House File 3. This is not a working families bill. And I don't even know that it's a wealth class bill. It's just cruel. I mean, right. I guess I keep coming back to that because I believe government. Our government is how we make lives better. It's how we do collectively the things we can't do individually. Ending childhood hunger is a huge thing to me. No child should go to bed hungry. No veteran should have to sleep on the street. We should be doing big things, and yet we're fighting over, well, someone went to the bathroom. I hear there's a kitty litter box somewhere. It's crazy.
Wealthiest nation in the world.
And for me, JD, the part of this that we fight this back is by doing just what you're doing, getting in the House, state House seats, fighting the good fight, coming on programs like this and talking about standing up for working people. And I appreciate the work that you do. So last line of questioning I've got for you, you're in the minority there. You know, any hope for Iowa turning around? Because I'll be honest, we went through a number of places through your state, met good, decent, hardworking people in rural communities who have been over misinformed, who have been lied to, and look, are struggling. I mean, the reality is we went to a lot of places that used to produce things, that used to have good union jobs. How do we get back into those places and reclaim and fight for those hearts and minds?
I'll say this is that I ran for Congress for 4 straight years in a district that had 70,000 more Republicans than Democrats. And when you go out there and talk about policies that Democrats are for, people don't turn you away. But when you mention you're a Democrat, that's when they get that look on their face that, yeah, that, oh, well, I'm not that. And so therein lies the struggle. And like what we talked about with mis and disinformation and local radio. So if you're going to run in a state like this, and if we're going to change it back to being a proudly purple state that we were and that I grew up in, we have to overcome so much more. And you have to work five times as hard. And in that, I mean, that's literally, I was in an RV going from town to town for four straight years in my congressional runs and came darn close, but we still lost. And so we have a ton of work to do. But when you actually talk one-on-one with individuals, for the most part, people are willing to give you a listen. That's what we get so caught up with the way we campaign. We buy all this TV ads. That's not going to get it done. You got to get out there and talk to the people. Yep. And at the end of the day, that to me, like, that's what campaigning's all about. Getting out there, talking to people, giving your message. And if we do that enough, and we have enough people running for House at all different levels, that's how we win back this state.
No, good stuff, JD. I wish you the best. Get in there and fight for the good folks in Iowa. I look forward to having you come back and tell us what's going on.
Absolutely. Always appreciate you.
Good stuff, our good friend JD Scholten. And look, I mean, that House File 3 is just bad. And it's good to have someone like JD in there fighting for the folks there. I'm going to take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-866-416-RICK. 1-866-416-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Fan of the show, you've heard our Labor History in Two segments, and you can hear them on the radio pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Labor history has never been more important than it is right now. So here's what we'd like you to do. Tell a teacher. Tell a teacher that labor history is important and that they can get digestible two-minute lessons that are absolutely free. Free to download, free to use, free to share. Tell a teacher to go to thericksmithshow.com/history and help us put labor back where it belongs, in the classroom. You know, generations of American workers fought, bled, and died to build the American way of life. It's our job to keep their stories alive. Go tell a teacher that we're here to help them do just that. Find us at thericksmithshow.com/history today.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I got to tell you, I really like him. Good guy. You know, when we went out to Sioux City during our Working Class Heroes tour, gave us the nickel tour and did a really amazing job of pulling people together to talk about what's going on in that community. And interesting, you know, the Union Hall there, the CWA Hall, used to be a strip club. It's right next to one of these giant grain elevators, and it was, you know, the wind was incredible and the grain dust and all this stuff, and you go, you know, interesting environmental stuff. But here's the thing, when we talk to people on the street and we talk to people while we were there, he's right. When you focused on policy, when you said, hey, what can help make your life better? What is it that can be done that's going to help? And education was the number one thing. So when they come up with this voucher scheme that I'm sad to hear pass, because it's a bad thing. And I know, but Rick, we'll have your child will have a golden ticket and they'll be able to get into the best private schools. No, they're not. If you gave every kid the golden ticket to go to the premier private schools, you know, the ones where our wealthy and elite send their children, they wouldn't let you in. And this is one of those moments where I go back to when Pennsylvania was pushing for this, They had a state senator, Mike Fulmer, who now well disgraced for some well, I'm not going to go into to the stuff he was involved in, pedophile. But he came on the air and said he wrote the bill. He knew the bill back and forth, and he told me that if my kid got this golden ticket, this wonderful voucher, that I could send them to any private school. So I said, how can I send them to the Abington Friends School in Philadelphia, where kindergarten is like $50,000 a year? And he told me absolutely, it would cover every bit of it. I go, every bit of it, and transportation. So I'm going, seriously, you're going to have a bus take my kid from here to Philadelphia every day and back so that they can go to this elite private school that only a handful of rich people can get their kids into? You're telling me that they're going to let the kid of a dumb truck driver into that environment? Never going to happen. But that's what they're peddling. They're selling this kernel. Oh, you're going to be able to send your kid to private school. And everyone goes, hey, private school is great. Look at the elite. The rich, they send their kids to private school. Do you know why they send their kids to private school? Smaller class sizes, less rigidity, more liberal arts, more experiential learning. None of this grill and drill and high stakes testing and big classrooms and no recess, which is what we've done to public education. Because we've got conservatives and corporate Democrats, Obama and Arne Duncan, to blame for a big part of this. But also George W. Bush and all of this, the Jebs and all of the people who are grifting off of our education dollars, putting in this, we've got to test for outcome. We've got to know, is our children learning? The greatest Bush line. We've got to know, is our children learning? So we got to have these high stakes tests. Which we have opted our kids out of every year that they've gone to school because they're garbage. And we tell the kids, I'm not against testing, love testing. There should be a test every Friday. Test you what you learned Monday through Thursday. So on Monday, we know what you learned so that you don't get far behind. Diagnostic testing. So we know where you are. And we use that to make sure that you catch up. Not these high stakes testing, which is you take a test for 2 weeks in March, April, and then in November you get the results. And it's not about making kids' educational opportunities better. It's about punishing schools and punishing teachers. That's conservatism. And I had someone, email me and say, well, you're the problem. You keep, complaining, Republican and conservative and talking points are conservative and corporate. I'm going, no. The current Republican Party and the conservative movement are both the same. They're both radical. Radical, and their ideology is a failure. Look what it has done to the working class. That's not correct. It's a failure for working people. It's a failure for people who get up and go to work and punch a clock and support their families and work hard, play by the rules. Those are the people that it's horrible for. For the folks who sit at the top of the mountain, people looking down on the rest of us in their ivory towers, working perfectly. Because we have crushed a prosperous working class. We have crushed the ability of families to get ahead. But at least we're going after the queers. I mean, stop and think about the mentality that goes into that. And this is where my frustration is. And this is where, when we're going through Iowa and having conversations with people, we're talking about all of the policies that Biden was moving on, infrastructure, bringing jobs back through manufacturing, investing in rural broadband and all of this stuff. People were 100% behind it. But you said, hey, this is what Biden's doing. No, he wants that. Bang, 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 talking point of litter box, drag show, CRT. And you go, no, that's not reality. But it's what they've been force-fed. And this is why it's so important to correct the wrongs and continue to fight for good policy that are going to make people's lives better. Proof's in the pudding. You get out there, you do the hard work. You get out there, you make lives better. You got a chance. And this is where I'm hoping, over the next two years, we end up taking on some of the crazy. We end up taking on some of the ridiculousness that we see from our Republican friends. We end up you know, maybe standing up and fighting back of some of the things that they've been getting away with. You know, that's kind of the hope. At least that's my thought. I'd love to hear yours. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Tell us what you think. Also, if you miss any portion of the program, make sure you...
The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk. From Muskego to Pewaukee, always streaming at waukradio.com.
CBS News Brief. Cheng Li Zhao, accused of killing co-workers at two farms in Northern California, is charged with 7 counts of murder, 1 count of attempted murder. Meantime, Vice President Kamala Harris tells survivors and relatives of the 11 victims killed in a Monterey Park dance hall shooting.
We will always, as a compassionate nation, mourn for the loss and pray for those who survive.
A lawyer for the Newport News, Virginia teacher shot allegedly by a 6-year-old student says there were warnings by the boy that the boy had the gun. The school board, including member Douglas Brown, votes to fire Superintendent George Parker III.
We do have to move in a new direction as a board.
Meta is reinstating former President Trump to Facebook and Instagram after a 2-year suspension. CBS's Musa Deek Bidar.
The announcement comes as Trump ramps up his third presidential campaign. The former president said he should have never been kicked off the platform to begin with.
CBS News Brief. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
The Shaw 101 FM. Brookfield's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Governor Evers wants to boost spending for public schools by $2 billion, raise mental health care spending to $500 million, and invest more money in Wisconsin's job market.
And not because anyone wants to make government bigger, but because Wisconsinites want a government that works and works better.
Evers gave his State of the State speech last night. Republicans say most of Evers' proposals won't get far. Hundreds of people who work at Energizer battery factories in Portage and Fenimore are worried about their jobs. Their unions say the company plans to move operations to North Carolina and England. The unions say the Wisconsin factories might close in a year or two. In sports, the Bucks host Denver tonight. You're listening to The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK, 540 AM.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba.
Please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Hey, this is Matt from Design Garden. Remember when the internet was new? Back then you had to leave your house to start a business. Companies used to pay programmers bags of cash to get online. Now, small businesses can get online with a Facebook business page, or Squarespace, or Google My Business, or WordPress. But which tools should you use? Can you afford to go down the wrong path? Design Garden uses modern tools to build your website the right way. Find us online at design.garden. Again, that's design.garden.
Governor Tony Evers, Tim Michaels said you had gone, quote, full woke. Dr. Jill Underlie said that somebody who says that has no idea what we're doing in schools to make sure kids feel safe.
We want to make sure all kids feel supported. Tim Michaels, we don't teach CRT in our schools. You got to come to the present century here, Tim, and be cognizant of what actually goes in the schools. My guess is you've never been in a public school in Wisconsin.
Up North News Radio with Pat Krylo airs at its new time from 6 to 8 a.m. weekdays across Civic Media.
Finish your high school diploma for you and your family. Visit finishyourdiploma.org to find free adult education centers near you. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
An enticing new source of labor activism for unions that are organizing at Starbucks, Amazon, McDonald's, etc. Why not a Wall Street banker union? Solidarity forever, brothers and sisters.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the EU is moving on a policy that I like. This is good. They're moving on a policy to get member countries to reach collective bargaining coverage rates of over 80%. Now here, understand, in the U.S., we're just above 10%. So to say that you're going to have 80% unionization in your country, mind-blowing for us here in the U.S. But you know what? This is how we rebuild, revive, and reunite a working class. This is how we bring people back together. Build a prosperous working class. And here to share some thoughts on what the EU is doing, and maybe we can steal some of that. I've asked David Madlin to come talk with us. David is the strategic director of the American Worker Project at the Center for American Progress. He's also the author of the book Reunion: How Bold Labor Reforms Can Repair, Revitalize, and Reunite the United States. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, Rick, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So walk me through what we're seeing going on in the EU. I was looking at your piece where they're talking about getting unionization rates of 80%. I'm going, yeah, that. Let's do that.
Well, yes, this is remarkable in a lot of ways. You know, one of the big ones is that they're setting such a high standard. So now the European Union, most of the member countries have higher union rates than the United States. But to be clear, most of the countries in the EU are not at that high a level. They're well below. Even places like Germany are well below. You know, only the kind of the Nordic countries are really, that's, you know, the Scandinavia, the Swedens and the Denmarks of the world are really at that level. Most of the EU is below, and some well below. So it's remarkable that they're setting this really ambitious target that they want every country to have near universal collective bargaining coverage. And I think not only is the standard really important, but, and you know, there's some policies that's actually going to help. What's really going to matter, though, of course, is how the member countries are going to implement this, all the things the member countries need to do to get their collective bargaining coverage to 80%. And then the last thing is, it's really important why they did this as well. And I want to make sure we get into the sort of why behind this as well.
No, the why is important, because I was just reading a report that came out of the UK that said that, you know, their wages have been stagnant for 40 years. And the one line in it is they should have, I think it was like a 40% higher standard of living for the working people in that country, because they've gone through the same kind of, not to the extremes that we have, I would argue, that the same kind of shift in worker power, going with the pendulum swinging to the wealthy and the powerful away from the people who actually create the wealth, working people, the same thing that we've gone through, and they're just responding to it maybe a little bit differently. And that's what I see in this. Am I off base?
No, that's my impression as well. So the basic trends in the United States, where we've had wages stagnant for decades, for especially people without a college degree, where we've had record levels of inequality, and we've had a really crumbling democracy, or real threats to the sort of quality of our democracy. The similar trends are playing out in many other countries. And I think the European Union saw that and were afraid. Like Donald Trump was not just a U.S. phenomenon. There's real fear in a lot of other sort of countries of kind of a right-wing semi-fascist takeover, where you play on cultural fears, you know, fears of immigrants, fears of foreigners, fears of others. In large part, you can do that because the economic situation for so many people is not very good. And so they're much more willing and able, and like, we want something different. This is, you give us a solution. And the other policymakers weren't giving them anything. We're saying, hey, free trade is going to help you, or some other BS. So, because the EU, until very recently, was part of the problem. They actually, for many of their policies, especially after the financial crisis in 2007, were actually to weaken labor unions. And then they started to see the impact of this. Oh, my goodness, we're destabilizing these countries. And now they're much more rapidly than in the U.S. Oh, my goodness, we need to do something. And we're going to really put our foot on the scale and say unions and collective bargaining are very, very good thing, not only for the economy, but for all of society.
No, and the thing is that's been the thesis of this program for the last 18 years, because I've watched as, you know, You know, I lived through the deindustrialization of where I grew up in Cleveland. I watched the lunchroom change over from people who were fighting for economic issues, better wages, hours, conditions, to now being twisted and in the wind with all of these cultural and social issues that don't affect their lives at all. And we've become a much more angry country over things that don't affect us, we can't control, and really shouldn't even care about while we're being fleeced. So, I mean, I'm glad someone in this on this planet is waking up to the reality, and the pendulum might be swinging back a little bit. Do you have any hope for that kind of idea coming here? Because I know we saw in California where they passed the fast food workers situation. Do you see that taking hold here with the right-wing media? I know they're going to scream socialism because you hear it coming already. Do you have any hope that?
I have hope, but it's very cautious for a lot of reasons. So the reasons for hope, and we've talked about this before, you know, unions are more popular now than almost any point. 70% approval ratings. You can't get 70% support for almost anything. You have half of workers saying they want to join a union. And then you have policies like things like sectoral bargaining or sectoral standard setting, where you're covering all workers in an industry with a collective bargaining agreement, which is essential to getting these high coverage rates. That's so there's an aside, but the EU policy, you know, 80%, all the unions there, all the academics say the only way to get that is sectoral bargaining.
Right.
So then in the US, we have policies like.
Didn't we have that here? I mean, you know, there were pockets of that here in this country. I mean, when I started working, I worked under the National Master Freight Agreement that covered 85% of the less than truckload in the sector of the trucking industry. Back when I started, it was 85% unionized. It's down to about 10% now. The auto industry almost was universally unionized. We had that kind of environment here that did raise standards, that did make lives better. And, you know, bad policy and you know, Republican presidents and bad politicians destroyed, I think, both of those. Is that kind of where your mindset is when you talk about sectoral bargaining?
Exactly. It's the system that built the middle class in the United States. We generally thought of it as just, oh, unions were stronger. But the way they bargained when they were stronger was to cover most all workers in a sector or an industry with similar standards. And it really worked quite well. The problem, as you mentioned, is sort of the politics changed. The employers fought more vehemently. And as union density declines in these industries, they couldn't hold the bargain together. So that now, because our law is so weak and the way it structures it, we bargain worksite by worksite and get very little too often. So there are policies that are pushing to make the broader based kind of bargaining easier and more doable. And they're especially important when union density is so weak, because we don't want to wait decades and decades for density to, even if we passed a policy that was going to increase, you know, union density, it would take quite some time. We want coverage also to increase very rapidly. And the way to do that is both increasing union density and improving the way we bargain, so we're not just bargaining worksite by worksite, but also can bargain at a broader level. And yes, California is a start. That's a sectoral standards board. And there's other states, Minnesota, I anticipate some major action perhaps there this year. But just to go back to the politics, California today, I think it's today, the fast food industry that hates the sectoral standards board there got a ballot initiative to overturn the standards board. They got it on that. They got it approved. So there's going to be a vote, and that's going to stall the implementation. Again, it's just an indication of how bad our politics are in the United States and how much power corporations have to prevent the will of the legislature to actually be enacted.
Yeah, no, and it's, again, it's another one of these moments where the pendulum has swung so far to the extreme on the corporate side that we've given them all the power and money. Even though we've out-procreated them, they've still been able to slice us and dice us and divide us. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with David Madlin. David is the strategic director of the American Worker Project at the Center for American Progress. You can check out their website, americanprogress.org. He's also the author of the book, Reunion, How Bold Labor Reforms Can Repair, Revitalize, and Reunite the United States. We'll get links out on how you can pick that up. A good read. Now, you know, here's the thing. This is where you come back to, you know, how do we, in this country with our bad, broken labor laws, how do we get to a place where we have this sectoral bargain? I brought up the National Master Freight Agreement. This was, you know, this was the Teamsters' crowning achievement. They were able to organize all of these companies where there was a floor, and it did raise up conditions for the people who weren't union members. I would love to see that, but I don't know that our labor laws would allow for that. I mean, because we're hell bent on the NLRB and doing these individual elections. Because I'm sure you've seen it, all of this energy around, you know, people going on strike and all this energy of people joining unions, density fell this past year. The stat that you brought up, 71% of people, you know, want to see labor unions you know, be better and improve. But the other part of that is 53% said they didn't want to be union members. So the messaging on the right has been very effective. And I fear that while we're going, yeah, we love unions, people aren't seeing the benefit yet. Or am I off base here?
Well, you're right that people aren't seeing the benefit because they're not able to join a union as often. So they're not seeing the benefit. And there certainly are some people who have been swayed and convinced by the, you know, corporate story or don't like unions or had a bad experience. But generally, a whole lot more people want to join unions than currently are able to.
Right.
That's just a huge difference. You know, just 6% of the private sector is unionized, which is lower than before the National Labor Relations Act was passed in the 1930s, giving workers some legal rights. But those rights have been so undermined. And you mentioned master freight. So not only the undermined rights, but the way we could bargain has also been undermined. As you probably know, that master freight agreement was based not only on union density, but also the tactics you were able to use. You could pressure other employers, not just the direct employer, to encourage everyone to be part of the deal. And those kind of tools have been taken away from workers. So there's a whole lot that needs to change to get us to the kinds of bargaining structures that really worked for the middle part of the 20th century. But I'm optimistic. And I see this EU deal as a big part of the growing momentum towards sectoral bargaining. So the EU represents dozens of countries, but recently so did New Zealand and Australia, just in the past couple of months, also passed sectoral bargaining bills. So this is real momentum. And then of course, California, a sectoral standards board, there's a big movement going on here.
No, and that's a good thing. I hope it's contagious. I hope it gets here, and I hope it spreads like wildfire, because at the end of the day, there's a lot of wealth being created in this country by our labor and not being shared with working people all along the spectrum. And, you know, we've got a $7.25 minimum wage, which is pathetically low. It hasn't been raised in, what, 13 years now? And yet I look at, you know, what they're doing in some of these EU countries, or what the EU wants to do is to raise, what was the language you said they used? Raise the minimum wage to a sufficiently high level to provide a decent standard of living. And they actually define what that is. I wish we could have that conversation.
Yeah. And one of the, you mentioning the remarkable, another remarkable thing about this EU policy is it's to increase minimum wage and collective bargaining. And these two policies are seen as complementary. They want to have a high legal floor through minimum wages. And then they also want to have a high floor with collective bargaining that builds upon the minimum wage, because, you know, the minimum wage is a minimum floor that many, many industries and occupations where the minimum standards should be well above that basic legal floor. And the EU is recognizing that it's not, oh, we support minimum wages or we support unions. They actually can and should be complementary.
You know, and one of the things that you pointed out, that in states, in countries that have, or even in, I would argue in states in this country that have higher union density rates, they also have higher minimum wage requirements. Is that accurate?
Exactly. And that, you know, the mechanism there is, you know, a couplefold, but largely it's that union members, when you join them, you have more political power. So you have, you're more likely to vote, more likely to, you know, participate in politics. You also have the union representatives working behind the scenes in the, you know, quarters of Congress, actually pushing for the policies that workers support. So you have them getting enacting pro-worker policies when unions are high, more union density is higher, and you have better collective bargaining that leads to higher wages and benefits. So yeah, they really work together there.
Yeah, I mean, you also point out that in the U.S. we kind of have one of these mechanisms in the prevailing wage laws. Can you explain that a little bit? Explain what prevailing wage is and how it helps? Because, you know, I'm a big supporter, and I know a lot of my Republican friends are not. And again, I don't think most people understand why it's become an ideological football. Now, I remember in my lifetime, I don't think I'm that old, but there used to be Republicans, a lot of them, that supported prevailing wage. There aren't as many today, but there used to be a lot of people who supported this because they knew it was good for communities. Thoughts?
Yeah, well, first, just on the politics. So there are a handful of Republicans in Congress that support prevailing wage laws, which in these days is remarkably bipartisan. But what a prevailing wage says is that on, you know, a government contract, companies need to pay at least the so-called prevailing wage, which is defined as kind of the local market wage, so that when workers have some power in a market, that rate is what other, you know, other subsidized employers are going to have to pay, so that government spending is not driving down standards that typically unionized workers were able to bargain for. So, and it even says that when the union density is high enough, when the union wage covers enough workers, that is the prevailing wage, and all subsidized employers have to pay that rate. And so it really protects the unionized workers. It also extends the benefits of the union contract to other employers, which helps the workers, but it also creates a level playing field for employers to compete on. And it's a really good thing that works. You know, there's lots and lots of research showing all these benefits for the communities, more greater investment in the community, more money staying home because the workers stay there. They're not being undercut. It's absolutely kind of one of the critical pieces that makes a functioning society.
No, and it's one of those things where you go, this is, as we're moving towards this gig kind of employment with so many people as gig workers, it's this model that I think the building trades model is a good way forward as well, because it's kind of in line with sectoral bargaining, but also giving people who aren't considered employees some power to bargain and have decent wages and conditions and all that. So to me, that's the way forward. So last question I've got for you, outside of reading your book, and I hope folks will get a copy of your book, Reunion, How Bold Labor Reforms Can Repair, Revitalize, and Reunite the United States. We'll get links out on social media. I get that. Outside of getting your book and reading that, what should people be doing to move us in this direction?
Well, I think if they live in California, they can certainly be supporting the workers' efforts to create their sectoral standard board and opposing the fast food industry's efforts to overturn. And then other states, there's going to be efforts. So for example, Detroit recently created a sectoral standards board. They can support that. There's so lots, and encourage, especially that's what's important about these kind of policies, the sectoral standards board, is that cities and states can do them, not just Congress. So everywhere you are, you want to push your elected official to encourage these kind of policies.
There you go. Good stuff. David, I appreciate the time, man.
Thanks for having me.
David Madlin, he is the strategic director there at the Center for American Progress's American Worker Project. And again, make sure you check out his book, Reunion. We'll get links out on social media. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. After an election, have you ever found yourself scratching your head, wondering why it seems that working people vote for candidates who don't represent their interests? Well, that feeling's nothing new. Back in 1912, Ernest Rebbe of the Industrial Workers of the World created the comic strip character Mr. Block. Mr. Block was drawn with a head that was a big square wooden block. In the comics, he often sides with management against his fellow workers. Mr. Block clings to the notion that if he just works hard enough and plays by the rules, he too can have a slice of the American dream of wealth and power. Yet time and again, his dreams are dashed. For example, in one comic strip, Mr. Block gets laid off from work. In other strips, Mr. Block gets harassed by the police, cheated out of wages, and hurt on the job. Yet through it all, Mr. Block often sticks with management. We might all know some modern-day Mr. Blocks. So, on this day in labor history, the year was 1913, and wobbly organizer and songwriter Joe Hill wrote a song just for them.
Please give me your attention, I'll introduce to you a man that is a creditor, red, white, and blue. His head is made of lumber and solid as a rock. He is a common worker, and his name is Mr. Block. And Block, he thinks he may be president someday. Oh, Mr. Block, you were born by mistake. You take the cake, you make me ache. Go tie a rock on your block and go jump in the lake. I may do that for liberty's sake. Yes, Mr. Block is lucky, found a job by G. The shark got $7.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick at therickssmithshow.com. I do want to go back to something, though, that prevailing wage thing. That gets people all in you know, glazed over in their eyes. Oh, I don't know. And the right-wing messaging is, that's the union wage. No, it's not the union wage. That's not how the law is written. No, sorry. The fact that unions report their wages and are proud of the wages that they bargain for and that the contractors are pay for their labor, the fact that they report this stuff, okay, then you could go, yeah, maybe it is the union wage because unions are proud of the wages they get. In fact, they publish their wages in a book. You know, they come out with their contracts. I've got my grandfather's contract from 1954 on my desk when he was a tank haul driver. We write this stuff in books. There's no secret to how much he made in 1953 or 1954. Same thing with my contract, the Master Freight Agreement. There's no secret. It's right out there in the open for everyone to see. Now, you go into some corporate settings, they'll fire you if you tell your coworker how much you make. And I've had numerous people over the years tell me, I know someone who got fired because they asked. So when you look at this prevailing wage, the unions are reporting their wages. It's in the book. It's not hard. So if that's the wage that's most often paid in that area, that's going to be the prevailing wage because that's what it is. It's not a minimum. It's not an average. It's the wage most often paid. If you got 6 people out of 10 making $10 an hour, you got one guy making 20, you got 3 guys making 5, the prevailing wage is going to be what? It's going to be the $10 an hour. That's how this is calculated. So it's to make sure that you don't drop the bottom out of an area. Also, to make sure that, well, when we have these building projects, they help. They infuse money in the local economy so that the local shopkeep can keep the doors open, local restaurant, the local movie theater, the schools can have revenue coming in. It's a good thing. So for me, when I see these kind of setups coming along saying, hey, we do need sectoral bargaining, because I benefited from it. The Master Freight Agreement was incredible in raising standards of living and wages. And as it's been broken down and as it's been destroyed, thank you, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, for trucking deregulation, the standard of living of people working in that industry has gotten worse. So for me, if we can do something to raise up the conditions for working people, get them more access to bargaining, sitting down with the employer and saying, this is what our labor is worth, I think we should be moving in that direction. Now, will we? Oh, no. Trust me. Corporate America is not going to go without a fight. And as was pointed out, California passed a law to help fast food workers, going to set a floor under fast food workers' feet, make sure that the billions that the industry is making, a little of it actually trickles down to the workforce. And they're going to spend billions to overturn that because they like their hands at 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock on the steering wheel. They like driving the car, even if they're driving our economy into the ditch for working people. But for themselves, oh boy, are they happy. And this is one of those moments as a working person, as a working person, we should be going, yeah, we want strong unions. We want, even if you're not a member, we want strong contracts. We want high road employment. We don't want race to the bottom employers. We don't want people, bottom feeders, harming companies that want to do the right thing. Because look, not all companies are bad. Some want to do the right thing. Problem is that one low rider, that one freeloader, that one at the bottom that tears everything apart. More for them, less for everyone else. That's the problem. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcasts, you'll find ours. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.